This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our topic today on the program, cats. Our guest is Atlantic Monthly correspondent Stephen Budiansky. He's the author of 7 books about animals. His latest is The Character of Cats, The Origins, Intelligence, Behavior, and Stratagems of Felis Silvestris Catus. This is the opening paragraph from the book. There are no search and rescue cats, guard cats, seeing eye cats, bomb detecting cats, drug sniffing cats, escaped convict tracking cats, sheep cats, sled cats, gun cats, obedience trained cats, frisbee catching cats, or slipper fetching cats. This is a matter of considerable relief. To tell the scientific story of dogs is to risk bringing down the wrath of legions of myth-soaked animal lovers, saturated as they are with tales of canine derring do, loyalty, and unconditional love, whatever that means. No one has any illusions about cats. Cats are cats, and any real cat owner knows it. That constant fraction of the human race that stalwartly admires and enjoys the company of cats long ago realized that they had better accept cats on their own terms, for the cats would have it no other way. Listeners, I invite your questions about cats this afternoon. I also invite your observations and stories about cats. Join us with a telephone call. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL and 333-WILL. Stephen Budiansky's earlier books include The Truth About Dogs, The Nature of Horses, If a Lion Could Talk, and Battle of Wits, The Complete Story of Codebreaking in World War II. His new book, The Character of Cats, is published by Viking. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Stephen Budiansky, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Hi. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
I suspect you are among that constant fraction of the human race that enjoys and admires the company of cats.
I do. I confess it.
Me too.
I won't tell you how they compare to dogs and horses on my list, though.
Okay. Now, I'm wondering if you live with one cat or many cats.
Well, we have 3 cats.
And what are their personalities like?
They're very different. And in fact, that's one of the things I talk about in my book, is that there's actually been some scientific research done on cat personality, and they really cover the gamut. We live on a small farm, and unfortunately, because of reasons of human allergies in our house, our cats have to stay outside. But they're happy being barn cats. One of them definitely is a very gregarious cat, and he's convinced he should be inside, and I wish it could be so, but he always tries to sneak in under the dogs and things like that. The two others are more of on the fraidy cat end of the personality range and tend to spend a lot of time hiding under dark objects. You know, the study I mentioned, that it was actually done at Cambridge University, mm-hmm. and they spent a lot of time really examining the components of individual cats' behaviors, and then did some really good statistical analysis on sort of what characteristics tend to track other characteristics. And they found there's really 3 basic personality types. These are my terms, not theirs. I mean, there was the fraidy cats who were tended to basically avoid contact. There were the easygoing cats, which were confident and in some ways sort of domineering, but not hostile or aggressive. There were the bossy cats who were definitely tried to throw their weight around.
Yeah, I live with a bossy cat.
You do, yeah.
Yeah. Over my life, I've lived with all 3 of these types, bossy, timid, and easygoing.
Yeah.
And the easygoing cat was a delight, but I'm quite happy with my bossy cat.
Well, you know, the one good thing about them is that they are alert and maybe energetic isn't quite the right word, but they, they're aware of what's going on around them, and bossy cats are also sociable. I mean, they want to interact. the timid cats are not sociable and not even terribly alert about what's going on now, and they probably don't make the best pets. Of course, easygoing is everyone's ideal.
Yeah, yeah. The poor timid cat. I just feel for those cats. You know.
The thing is that some of them are born and some of them are made. I think there's some pretty good evidence that these social characteristics are inherited to some extent. One study found a definite paternal influence. It doesn't just mean that fathers have a disproportionate effect. It's hard to separate out the sort of genetic and social effects the mother has because she's right there bringing up the kittens. But the other half was very clearly whether they were handled and had social experience as kittens. Especially the critical period seems to be from 2 to 7 weeks with kittens. And if they're exposed to beings other than their mother and their litter mates during that period, there's a much higher likelihood that they will be sociable and friendly and easygoing as adults.
Mm. You write in the book that cats may be the original underachievers.
Yeah.
To what extent can we influence the behavior of our cats? Like, for example, if you were to take in a kitten today, what would you do to foster its intelligence and influence its personality?
Yeah. Well, like I said, as far as personality goes, the really critical period seems to be about 2 to 7 weeks. And there's a similar socialization period that you see in dogs, though that tends to start later in puppies and have sort of a less definite cutoff. In the socialization studies that were done with cats, there really seemed to be the window really comes slamming down at about 7 weeks. So, in a way, the most important thing is to make sure your kitten has had that lot of handling and interaction with people in its home before you get it. As far as intelligence goes, there's some evidence from studies that, I sort of have this picture of cat owners, treating their kittens as like super kids and showing them Russian flashcards or something. And I don't want to overdo this, but there is some evidence that cats that are exposed to sort of stimulating, challenging learning problems tend to learn more easily throughout their life. And it's a matter of probably nothing more than just having the opportunity to play with objects and to get a certain amount of attention every day. And probably they don't need a lot. I'm not sure there's any really good studies that show how much attention they need. But it is clear that cats that have, for example, learn to solve certain kinds of problems, like, the classic one is you teach the cat that you present two different objects, like, a red pyramid and a black cube, and it has to, if it goes up and noses the pyramid, it gets a food reward, and if it noses the cube, it doesn't. And once a cat has learned a few of these sorts of problems, it learns subsequent problems of this sort much more readily. They actually seem to, you could say, learn to learn. So the more they're exposed to intellectual challenges, I suppose you could say, the more alert and intelligent they'll be, I think.
Mm. It's just like people.
Yeah, that's right, and actually like many other animals. I mean, the point, though, about cats being underachievers is that it literally is very hard to get them to show what they know. And when comparative psychologists were doing these sorts of learning experiments in cats, it was a really difficult challenge to design the experiments so the cats would even bother to do them.
Mm.
And, this is the common slander, of course, from dog partisans that cats are dumb, and then the cat people retort that, well, they're just too smart to do these stupid tricks for a biscuit or something. And there's actually an element of truth, I think, to the cat defenders' line there, because, for example, in one experiment, they took the cats, I mean, right before they would be fed each day. So in other words, they hadn't eaten for 23 hours, and they had the experiments designed so the cat would get an instant food reward when it got the right answer. And even then, the cats were often, as they said, lackadaisical in their responses. Part of it is that cats react very badly to punishment, and I'm not talking about, you know, physical punishment. I mean, they react sort of indifferently even to social disapproval,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, when you think about it, is actually a very important factor in training dogs to do what we, and horses for that matter, too, that, I mean, all you have to do is speak to your dog in a slightly displeased tone of voice, and he'll probably be, you know, rolling on his, on his back and whining and licking your hand and I mean, dogs are social animals, and so it's part of their basic social behavioral toolkit to want to make nice to the guy in charge of the pack so they don't get walloped all the time. Cats are descendants of solitary animals. I mean, the wild cat is solitary in its natural state, and they tend to react to any sort of social confrontation much more with a fight-or-flight
mm-hmm.
response.
Mm-hmm. Well, my bossy cat, he knows the word no, but often if that answer is not to his liking,
yeah.
he gives me this kind of yes.
Right, yeah.
You know,
exactly.
He comes right back at me.
That's the fight part, yeah. And and other cats will, you know, probably just ignore it or walk away. And the thing is that, I mean, again, a lot of this goes back to their basic evolutionary history, and this is one of the things I try to really explore in,
mm-hmm.
in researching my book, was how much can we understand about their behavior and behavioral problems and intelligence by looking at their basic natures, which I think is something that, it's funny, I mean, it's second nature to us to ask these questions about wild animals. I mean, we watch, you know, wildlife documentaries on TV, and all the time, that's the approach that's taken. But for our domestic animals, it almost doesn't seem to even occur to us to treat them this way, or I shouldn't say to treat them, I mean to analyze their behavior this way. And it's something I find very interesting in its own right, but I think it also has a real practical payoff.
Yeah. Well, they're so much a part of our lives, domestic animals.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, I think in a funny way, precisely because they're so much a part of our lives, we take them for granted. We don't view them. In fact, scientists have done the same thing. You know, for years, I think the attitude among animal behaviorists was, oh, domestic animals are degenerates. They're not very interesting to study. They don't show the full range of true animal behavior. And I suppose there was a certain amount of snobbery, and there was a certain amount of self-interest at work here, because it was always more exciting for animal behaviorists and zoologists to, you know, put on their safari jackets and go down some unbeaten track in Africa than to, you know, turn around and look at their cat. But one of the things that really inspired me to write the character of cats, and also my books about dogs and horses, was that really just within the last, I would say, 10-15 years or so, there's been a real explosion of basic scientific research on domestic animals. And so we're really learning an awful lot about their genetics and behavior and intelligence and abnormal behavior and evolution.
Oh. The first chapter of your book is titled Cats Plot to Take Over the World and Succeed. And in that chapter, you explain that cats are the least altered
yeah.
of domestic species. As you put it, they still have one foot in the jungle.
Yeah.
So how did cats come to put one foot in our living rooms?
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting question, because cats are the least tamed, the least changed, and the most successful, certainly, pet species. I mean, there's more pet cats than pet dogs in the United States now. Part of the story is that cats, I mean, let me back up. Cats defy the normal rules about domestication. almost all domestic animals, dogs, horses, even pigs, sheep, cattle, are social species. They're group-dwelling animals. So they already had something in common with us as humans, who are social species, group-dwelling animals. We have a common means of communication. We have a common understanding, instinctive understanding of social status and subordination and dominance and all of those things that are necessary for living in a group successfully. The interesting thing is that if you look at, say, dogs and wolves, dogs have diverged quite significantly from wolves, from a genetic point of view, from a behavioral point of view. They're not the same species. I mean, they can interbreed, that's true, though actually all members of this genus Canis can interbreed, so coyotes and dogs and so on, jackals. That in itself doesn't necessarily mean anything. But the point is they have diverged from their wild ancestor. There's a fascinating argument, which I think is increasingly being accepted by biologists, that really it was probably the proto-dogs, the ancient ancestor of the dog, the subpopulation of wolves, that took the first step, that it, essentially they evolved to exploit this niche that human society represented of providing food and warmth with campfires and protection from predators and so on. So here you have these social animals that approached us in the first step that changed quite significantly from a genetic point of view to become domesticated. On the other hand, you have cats, which are a solitary species, which have not changed. I mean, literally, the wild cat and the domestic cat are the same species. The genetic analysis that has been done has shown the difference is in the noise level. If you were to see an African wild cat, I mean, you would think pussy cat to look at it. It looks just like a tabby house cat. And yet, they've been so successful. Well, a lot of this has to do, I think, with the ancient Egyptians, and a lot of it has to do with a very peculiar sort of cultural inheritance in the cat species. The Egyptians, of course, brought in a great many different sorts of wild animals, hyenas and gazelles and ibexes and even crocodiles that they mummified and worshipped in some sense. Cats took, these other ones didn't. Now, it turns out that even though cats are solitary animals by their instinct, by their genetic programming, kittens that are brought up in a social environment, that is, with individuals other than their mother and their litter mates, are willing as adults to tolerate social ties. You find this in feral cats today, that is, house cats that are living on their own in the wild or semi-living on their own, like some farm cat groups you find. I mean, they might be fed by the farmer, but they have very little contact with people. Well, these colonies actually form social groups. They'll actually have large numbers of females that will rear their young communally even and even nurse one another's young. This is not behavior you see in the true wildcat. So they have this ability, as a result of their experience in kittenhood they've had themselves, of being in the social group, to maintain social ties as adults. That still doesn't quite explain this magic and mystery of their success in human society. I think what I sort of have come down to saying, and I say in my book, is that they went through this, I suppose you could say, cultural evolution bottleneck or in ancient Egypt, that the ancient Egyptians probably went out and just, you know, like they did with many different wild animals, brought cats in to human society. And once there was this critical mass of a population of cats that had been reared under this situation of having social contact as kittens, they then passed this on to subsequent generations. Again, I mean, not through a genetic change, but almost as this sort of cultural tradition that our house cats today are still heirs to.
Really interesting. Our guest this afternoon, Stephen Budiansky. He's a correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. He's the author of many books about animals. His latest is The Character of Cats, The Origins, Intelligence, Behavior, and Stratagems of Felis Silvestris Catus. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome your input into the conversation. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener on line one in Champaign. Hello.
Thank you. I find cat personalities pretty fascinating, and I have a couple of cats myself with different personalities. One of them was a lab cat for 6 years, and then was a practice cat for veterinary technicians. And he's very people-oriented. I mean, he will come and present himself to anybody who comes into the house, although people describe him as being very regal and bearing, because he doesn't really make over anybody other than me. He'll just, you know, go and present himself and expect his due. Whereas my other cat, who had been a stray, she tends to be very standoffish and very selective about who she will, you know, make up to. But once she decides that she likes you, she can be very shameless. Before I got these cats, I had occasion once to board somebody's cat for a couple of weeks while they had to, they were in transition and moving, and this cat would disappear. I mean, I would only get the rarest glimpse of it from scurrying behind a piece of furniture or something. You know, I would put food and water out, which would disappear, but this cat was, you know, like not there for 2 weeks until its owner came to pick him up, and then this cat totally ignored her and just was climbing all over me and, you know, rubbing on me and acting like I was its best friend in the world, just like having to send this message, you know, to her. Not, you know, wasn't if the cat really cared about me, but he had to get his point across about being abandoned for 2 weeks.
Well, let's ask Stephen Budiansky about that. What do you think's going on there?
Well, you know, and sometimes it's hard to know. You know, cats are very much tied to territory, and if a cat is moved to a new place, it's not at all unusual for them to exhibit this sort of behavior of really just hiding, and that's mainly, I think, frankly, a fearful reaction to being in an unfamiliar situation. This whole question of motivation and jealousy in cats and other animals is a very complex and fascinating question. It's often extremely difficult to really figure out what's going on. And honestly, I think, you know, at the end of the day, you'd have to say, well, unless we had a cat's mind and a cat's perception abilities, we really can't say what's going on. Clearly, they do share some of the same emotions as we do, but I think one of the really intriguing things, to me anyway, is how different they are as well. And, you know, I've never been one of these people who thinks that the ultimate compliment to an animal is to say you're almost human. I mean, I think the differences in animals are part of their fascination and their rich evolutionary history. And, you know, the situation that the caller's described to this cat coming out and paying attention to him rather than his owner, it's easy for us to say, oh, well, the cat is, you know, is making a statement here or is trying to get back at his owner for leaving him. You know, it's hard to disprove that, but I think that there's also at least some reasons to be a little bit skeptical of such interpretations, because as intelligent and as adaptable as cats and, for that matter, all non-human animals are, when you do these very careful experiments trying to, say, test whether a cat is, for example, capable of understanding the motive of another being rather than just reacting to the behavior of another being, they generally flunk those. And, in fact, even higher primates flunk those tests. So that always gives me a bit of pause myself in imputing human-like motives and intentions to animals such as cats. The other thing is, though, I mean, as long as I'm on this this sermon about differences between humans and animals, is that I think that sometimes we really make problems for ourselves and for our pets when we're too quick to ascribe human-like motives, particularly motives like revenge or trying to get back at us to our animals, because often the explanation is something simpler and less emotionally charged. And if we understand things from our cat's point of view, especially when there's problems that we're trying to solve, it often makes that job that much simpler. Whereas if we think that they're acting like, you know, our little sister would under such a situation, we can actually make things worse.
Mm. Well, I guess my counter to that would be that while I do agree that, you know, you're on thin ice sometimes when you talk about them having human-like behavior, on the other side of that, though, I would say, you know, the behavior is not necessarily so unique to humans. After all, Darwin believed that behavior is highly conserved through evolution. And, I mean, they do have a lot of the same brain structures where our emotional qualities tend to, come out of. And, I'm not so certain that, you know, these... Certainly emotions are not unique to human beings.
No, I certainly wasn't suggesting that they are, but by any stretch of the imagination. I think what I would argue from the studies that I've read is that the emotions that are unique to human beings are the ones that are colored by an understanding of what it is like to be in someone else's position, as it were. And so emotions such as... envy, for example, I think it's harder to find to demonstrate in non-human animals. Mm. But no, certainly, I think it's not only common sense, but I think there's good scientific evidence that many basic emotions certainly are quite similar among all mammals. And as you say, I mean that there are a lot of anatomical similarities in brain structure, which suggests that, and it would be surprising if that were not the case.
Mm. I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon, and I'm going to go to our next person in line to talk with us this afternoon, who is on a cell phone on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Hello?
Hi there.
Hi.
Do you have a question for us?
Well, actually, I don't have a question, but I'd like to share a little story that we have with our cats.
Uh-huh.
I was going to my grandmother's house, and we would go there, and there would be this cat, Mitzi, who was my grandmother's cat. But we would hardly ever see her in the 10 or so years that my grandmother's had her. My family has hardly ever seen her. And my grandmother last year had to go to a nursing home, so we had this cat. And so we decided that we would take her home with us, and we took her there, and she became the dryer cat. She would hide behind the dryer about day and night, but after a little while, she just sort of made a transformation. It was really kind of amazing. She went from this shy little cat who hid behind the dryer to this cat who would come up, and she'd roll over on her belly to be patted, so... You were talking about the different types of behavior, the bossy and the tentative and the easygoing, and she sort of changes from a tentative to an easygoing, and I just like to share that. So.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call this afternoon. I would think that that would be kind of rare.
Well, you know, some of it may have to do, too, with the change in situation, and, often... And this goes back to what we were talking about before, about seeing things from the animal's point of view. Often there can be things that we're simply not aware of, but which loom very large in the mind of the cat as either territorial intrusions or threats or stress factors. And, a good example of that is that, a lot of people have told me when I was researching my book, I obviously... gathering cat anecdotes from people as well as reading the scientific literature. And a lot of people would tell me about the situation where they've been away, they come home, they put their coat down on the couch or something, and the first thing the cat does is pee on their coat. You know, and they say, well, why does the cat do this? Is he mad at me because I've been away or something? And there's actually a lot of good scientific evidence that they tend to view things, especially things with, you know, odors of their people, of, I should say, individuals they consider part of their social group or social peers, as territorial intrusions. And so here's suddenly something that, I mean, they're very conscious of spatial relationships of things. All of a sudden, there's some new object where there wasn't one before that's carrying a strong social odor, and they're responding with a territorial mark on it. So there can be things like, I mean, to us, a coat draped over a sofa doesn't mean anything. To a cat, it can be something, you know, highly charged with territorial and social significance. Moving a cat to a new place, I think, you know, it's very common that they react by, you know, hiding behind the dryer or whatever for quite a while. It may be for a variety of reasons that this new home, though, when the cat finally got used to the change, was a less intimidating situation than its previous home. It is from the studies that I saw, I think it is unusual to see an adult cat, though, really change its personality dramatically. I mean, nothing is 100% and hard and fast when you're talking about animal behavior, but it seems pretty clear that parental genetic influence is important, and social influence during the 2 to 7 weeks period in kittenhood is very important, but those factors really tend to pretty strongly mold character or personality for the rest of their lives.
Mm. You know, you mentioned scent, and
yeah.
That is, you know, I know that here's an area where dogs win hands down, but cats they are very interested in smelling.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, that's a perfect example of something we just don't have a clue about. I mean, here's this whole sensory perceptual world, which is full of things of highly charged significance that we're not even aware of. Certainly smell is a very important part of the cat communication system.
Yeah. Well, my cat, in greeting, this is whether it's, you know, myself, my husband, or someone that comes into the house,
mm-hmm.
The first thing is he gives you a big rub.
Yeah.
And then, but before you can pet him, he wants to smell your hand.
Right.
It's like, where have you been and who are you?
Yeah,
okay,
I mean,
now
it's
all right.
Part of the checking out and recognition.
Mm.
And, you know, this business about rubbing, it's interesting. It may be an attempt to pick up your scent. It may be an attempt to mark his scent on you. And I think I tend to believe the latter explanation because you see them doing the same thing on sort of physical objects and landmarks in their terrain, that they will rub their cheeks against, you know, twigs or other objects outside that are at about the level another cat might smell.
Mm. Well, and there's also a couple of different kinds of rubs. There's the greeting rub, and then there's the big rub. The big rub means I want something.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's also, there's also a learning component in a lot of what cats do, which is interesting and which always, I think, greatly complicates any simple explanations one might be tempted to give for cat behaviors. They learn that if they do certain things, a certain result happens. They learn that certain sounds or certain actions on your part relate to certain things. I remember reading in one book, I think it was in Benjamin Hart's wonderful book about animal behavior, he talks about how he once saw an ad in the Lost and Found column in his local newspaper which said, lost calico cat answers to the sound of electric can opener.
Oh, let's talk with another listener on line 2 in Champaign. Hi.
Listen, you guys have just talked about what I was interested in learning more about. I have two cats. One has been a long-time resident, about 7 years old, Maine Coon cat, very much the boss. And then the stray showed up a year and a half ago. Well, Blackie is very kind of aggressive cat, and he wants to be the boss. So the two of them don't get along very well at all. The bottom line is Caesar, the Maine Coon, has been marking our entire house
yeah.
with his scent for about the last 6 months, and he will not quit.
Yeah.
I mean, I've tried, you know, I went to the Internet, and they said, well, isolate the cat that's not using the litter. You know, put the food and the litter and close the door and don't let the other cat in. Well, the other cat stands outside the door and headbutts it till the door comes open. The first thing he does is go and pee in the litter so the other cat won't use it.
Yeah. Well, you know, in my book I do talk about this problem of multi-cat households. And, I mean, the thing is cats are territorial animals by nature. And the more cats you have in the same space, the greater the chances of marking problems. And, in fact, in one study I remember reading, it said by the time you have 10 cats in a household, the odds of inappropriate elimination occurring is 100%. And one of the solutions that the experts recommend is making sure, like you have, you know, if you have two cats, have two litter boxes widely separated. Feed them in separate places, make sure they have, you know, each cat has places they can go and hide from the other, and just generally reduce the sort of territorial stress level. I mean, some of these problems, it seems pretty clear, you know, you just can't solve. I think when you have two, particularly if you have two dominant, aggressive type cats, you know, it's a tougher problem. The thing, though, is that you know, anything you can do to reduce the overall stress level is going to help the situation. But clearly, I mean, your resident cat, views this as a territorial threat, and he's responding the way cats always do under those situations.
Yeah. At other times, though, they can lie 2 feet apart from each other, just, you know, nose to nose, and they're the best of friends. It's just occasionally, and then I've also noticed there are now certain areas that the resident cat will frequent, and just drives you nuts.
You know, one of the reasons for that too is that they can, you know, it's almost this sort of Pavlovian conditioning that they can associate certain places where they've had a confrontation in the past. And that's why it can help to do some of the things you were talking about of separating them physically or closing off areas which tend to be the problem area, and then maybe gradually reintroducing them. Because, I mean, one of the anecdotes I give in my book of some of these sorts of strange learned associations was a cat that got alarmed. I mean, the cat was looking out the window, saw another cat out there. And then turned and attacked his owner, who had just walked into the room. And this is, I mean, this happens. It's called redirected aggression. But then what started happening is every time this cat's owner would walk into that same room, the cat would attack him. It wouldn't attack him in any other rooms. It didn't matter whether there was a cat outside anymore. And it was just that he had learned this association. So, you know, you can run into these sorts of situations, and really the only solution there is sort of patient re-education.
Well, one of the last question I have is, once you have this marked household, is there any kind of herb or solution? I mean, I've been on my hands and knees with the Nature's Miracle spray bottle.
Well, there are a number of enzymatic products which help remove the odor, and
that's about the best you can do, though.
I mean, people too who know more than I do say that those work fairly well, and that can be a problem in itself.
Fun and games, right? Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Run out and buy your book.
Well, thank you.
Okay,
thanks
bye-bye.
For the call this afternoon. Boy, she's got an appropriately named cat there, doesn't she?
Yeah, right.
Caesar. Let's talk with another listener in Oak Park on line, I think it's line one? Yes. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Andrew Jackson here.
Hi.
Hi. We have a cat. Her name is Zena. And I came to live with my partner about 5 years ago, and, you know, the cat was always very positive. But I'm nocturnal just about like the cat, and I build computer systems, so most of the time I'm up in the middle of the night working. And one night my cellular started ringing in another room, and I ran to go get the cellular, and in the dark the cat got kicked. And now I can't come near Xena. Xena
wow.
behaves as if she hates me. The second question is, we had a couch, and Xena just kind of scratched it into oblivion, so we bought a brand new one, and now we're concerned that we want to figure out how can we get Xena not to scratch the couch.
Yeah, no, those are two good questions. I'll, on the second one first, I mean, scratching is a territorial mark in cats. When you look at wildcat behavior, they will generally pick like one tree that's their marking tree and scratch it repeatedly. And it's a highly visible mark. It's basically, you know, a territorial mark to other cats. So once they're in the habit of scratching a couch in a certain place, they want to keep doing it. Benjamin Hart, who's a great expert, a veterinarian on domestic animal behavior, had an article about this in a veterinary journal, and he says that, you know, these scratching posts do work well, but you can't just, like, stick it out there and say, hey, cat, you know, I bought this expensive scratching post, so therefore you're supposed to use it. He says typically, he says what you can do, for example, is cover your couch with, you know, plastic, put the scratching post next to it, and then each day sort of inch the couch a few inches away, and eventually the cat will have transferred its instinct to the scratching post. He also talks about how sort of nubbier fibers that are that sort of have a cross weave aren't as satisfying for the cats to scratch, and they tend to not to want to scratch those as much. But I mean, really, I think the name of the game is to give them something that's an acceptable scratching post or scratching substitute and train them to use it. And once they're trained to use it, they will really stick with it.
Interesting.
As far as the, you know, tripping over your cat in the middle of the night, I mean, that can be a very difficult thing to unlearn, I think. And the major technique you find in the veterinary literature about these problems is what's called desensitizing. And basically, you've got to train your cat not to be afraid of you anymore. I mean,
yeah.
It really comes down to that. And, you know, you can do this by, for example, when you're feeding your cat, standing, you know, some distance away, in other words, far enough away that you aren't causing a reaction of, you know, I want to get away from this guy. And then each day, decreasing the distance, getting closer to the cat, just, you know, standing there innocuously. He's more used to you. I thought you were, in fact, going to say now every time the cellular phone rings, your cat runs and hides. But
funny. No, that's not what happened.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Anytime I run, then
she comes
to me and hisses.
It's actually running that sets it off, yeah. Well, you know, again, I think, you know, you might have some success with the same sort of desensitization technique of, you know, of walking and walking a little faster around the cat, and if that, you know, but doing it by very small degrees until you're back to being able to move abruptly without setting him off.
Yeah, and clearly you're pointing out that this whole process is going to be about patience.
Yeah, I think that's right, because, you know, one of the tough things about these sorts of learned associations is, especially with cats, is that, I mean, A, they react badly to punishment, so you can't just say, ah, knock it off, cat, like you could to a dog.
Yeah, I heard you talking about that
earlier.
Yeah,
and you know, and the other thing is that, you know, again, although they are willing to be social towards us to an extraordinary degree, they don't have that basic instinct to begin with. And so that's why it's particularly these sorts of things that a cat perceives as a sort of social conflict can be pretty hard to unlearn. But yeah, I mean, it's almost like you have to approach a cat like, you know, a circus trainer is approaching a wild animal in these situations.
And I think that every encounter should be a good one.
Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, that's the important thing in desensitization,
yeah,
is that you want to just by, you know, at each stage, not do anything that will set the cat off, but just, you know, slowly get him used to these increasingly intense stimuli without at any stage having him freak out.
I'm going to make one other comment, and then I'm going to hang up and listen. One of the things that I observed about the cat is that it'll come up to her and open its paw very, very wide, making sure that the claws are distended so that it doesn't scratch with the claws, and tap her on the shoulder to get her attention.
Hmm.
The first time I saw that, it was just amazing to me. It's like this extraterrestrial now is trying to communicate directly. It's an amazing experience. If you ever see it, you will be changed forever, and I was never a cat person. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks for the call. Anything to comment on there? Sounds like Xena's a pretty nice cat, actually.
Yeah, as long as he doesn't run.
Yeah, don't run. And everything should be, you know, maybe for a while, maybe you should be the person to supply the treats and anything else you can think of. You know, that easygoing cat once upon a time I lived with, she was just a wonderful cat. When my alarm would go off in the morning, she'd jump on the nightstand and she'd put her paw on my cheek.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, yeah, it's just, I don't know, you know, you can be so moved by just the, you know, just living with these animals. Just fabulous. Well, we're out of time, unfortunately. I really enjoyed the time that we could spend together today. And,
well, thank you.
And I hope maybe someday we'll do it again, and maybe we'll talk about another animal.
All right. Well.
Okay. Take care, and the best to you and your family and your three cats, the two timids and the one easygoing.
All right. Well, thank you.
Okay, take care. Stephen Budiansky has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His book, The Character of Cats, The Origins, Intelligence, Behavior, and Stratagems of Felis silvestris catus, is published by Viking.